Welcome back to the Rav Hirsch on Parsha series on OU Torah. My name is Michael Gutman, and this week we'll be studying Rav Hirsch's commentary on Parsha's Chaye Sara. Rav Hirsch begins this week's Parsha, like most Mefarshim, with an analysis of the opening Pasuk and its seemingly odd division of the years of Sara's life into three distinct groups. The Pasuk in the beginning of Perek Chav Gimel says, "Vayuchaye Sara me'osh shana ve'esrim shana ve'sheva shanim," that the years of Sarah's life were 100 years, 20 years, and 7 years. And Rashi on this pasuk cites the well-known saying of Chazal. Rashi says, "Lachach nichtav shana b'chol klal uchlal," that each group of years, the 100, the 20, and the 7, are split up, and it says the word years after each group, lo ma'alach, to teach you, shekol echad nidrash la'atzmo, that each group should be studied for itself, that it has a message about each group of years and how it compares to the other groups of years. That bas kuf kivas chaf l'chet, that Sarah at age 100 was the same as at age 20 in terms of sin. That ma bas chaf lo chata, Shahari Eina Bas Onshin, just as a 20-year-old has no sins because she is not at the age where she is can be punished for her averos. We know that the age of Onshin begins at age 20. Afas Kuf Belochet, she was equally guiltless at age 100. And Bas Kof Kvas Zion, and the comparison between 20 and 7 is Liyofi, at beauty, that at age 20 she was still as beautiful as at age 7. This is the one on Rashi on this pasuk, where Chazal compare 100 to 20 and 20 to 7. And Rav Hirsch cites this medrash, and he makes note of the fact that the three qualities that the three age groups really demarcate three periods in a person's life. 100, 20, and 7 are symbolize old age and maturity and youth. And first of all, what the Medrash is trying to say first, before he gets into the concept of chet and yofi, is the idea that Sarah took the positive qualities of each stage of her life with her to the next. So instead of abandoning the positive qualities of youth, she took that with her and kept it as part of her personality, even as she reached maturity and as she transitioned from maturity to her old age, she retained the positive qualities lesson of her adult life as she became an older woman and kept those positive lessons that she had learned. And reverse, this is really the definition of the expression used to describe Avraham in the next parak. The expression ba bayamim, where it says that Abraham zokein ba bayamim. Abraham was old, he was coming with the days. Or as Rav Hirsch prefers to translate it, he comes through the days. Meaning that he doesn't leave the previous days behind and move on to the next stage in life, but rather uses every single day as a building block to face the challenges of the next day. As Rav Hirsch says, and I'll quote the words of Rav Hirsch, he writes, "He does not sink in his days, nor is he swallowed up by them. Rather, he passes through them. He retains all the spiritual and moral attainments of his past and takes them with him into the future. He does not permit the days and years to rob him of anything that has become truly his." So, with this idea, first of all, it's a pshat in ba bayamim that is a lesson to all of us. To view each day of our lives as a building block for the next day, and that was always something we can take out of each individual day as a lesson learned and build on that the following day and use it to grow and not to really say today is over, today is finished. We put it in the past, we forget about it, and tomorrow we start new. Sometimes that's an important approach. Especially for a Baal Teshuva, that's often the prescribed approach. And when I say Baal Teshuva, I mean one who does Teshuva. But when it comes to building on what our how we've grown and our accomplishments, we hope to build off of every single day and climb higher and higher every subsequent day. That's the definition of Baba Yamim, of coming through the days, of taking the achievements of every day and using it on the following day. So with this understanding of the division of Kuf, Chaf, and Zayin of 100, 20, and 7, then Rav Hirsch uses this to explain the Medrash and the specifics of the comparisons, the specifics, specifically the comparison of 120 with regards to Chetz and the comparison of 20 to 7 with regard to Yofi. So Rav Hirsch also points out that this Medrash seems to be backwards compared to our modern sensibilities. The Medrash identifies 20 as blameless, as innocent, as free of sin, and identifies a seven-year-old girl as the epitome of beauty, and then has to say that at the following stage she retained the best of the previous stage, meaning a seven is the epitome of beauty, and she retained that beauty at 20. 20 is the epitome of blamelessness, and she still retained that purity, that innocence at age 100. And Rav Hirsch says, doesn't that seem backwards? We generally identify someone, a child, age seven, with innocence, with a child, we say, is free of sin. A child has not done anything wrong. And we identify beauty with 20. We talk about a mature woman would be more of an ideal of beauty than a young girl. So yet the Medrash is saying seven is beauty, and 20 is free of chet. How can that be when we compare this to which doesn't seem to fit with our associations of the different stages of life? But Rav Hirsch says that this is actually really a lesson to us, and it shows us how we properly should view things as they are in the world. And he explains that we can't call a child innocent. We can't call a child below chet, because a child has not had the opportunity to choose otherwise. And one person who has never had temptation to sin, a person who has never faced the challenges, is not someone we would call below chet, is not someone we would call innocent. And it's only at age 20, while having already faced the challenges, having gone through adolescence, having really moving as an individual into the world as an individual in his or her own right, at that, and yet remaining steadfast to his or her beliefs, and standing up to those challenges, and growing through them, that is below chet. One can only be below chet if he or she had the opportunity to follow chet, but still perseveres. And Rav Hirsch talks about this at great length. I would refer the listener to an essay that's in the 8th volume of the collected writings called Beauty and Long Life. It's on page 137 of the 8th volume. And here Rav Hirsch talks about this, the long life of Sarah, he says, the 127 years of Sarah, and quotes this Medrash and explains how our view of innocence does not fit with the view of the Torah. Rav Hirsch goes on in this essay and talks about how we define innocent as unsuspecting, someone who's too simple-minded to sin, but that is not the case. He says that the notion of what he calls saintly innocence, the idea of who he says a certain religious faith has vested this with a shining halo, this idea of saintly innocence, meaning someone is sainted because he doesn't know of sin. He doesn't have such challenges. He's too pure for that. Rav Hirsch writes here in this essay that such a notion is degrading to human nature. He says, no, we have challenges. We have nisyonos. We have a physical nature that confronts us daily. But when we resist the challenges that are posed to us, And even though we have challenges, we have self-control, and we make sacrifices to retain our purity and our innocence, to remain below chet. That's the epitome of below chet. So only a 20-year-old could truly be considered below chet. And it's a chiddush that, of course, at 20, she's below chet. But at age 100, to still be below chet, that's a big chiddush. So that's regardless, leaving aside the idea of the age of onshin, as Rashi mentions, but Rav Hirsch says that this is the idea of saying that a person who is age 20 is the epitome of below chet. Now, Rav Hirsch then continues and explains that the age 7 is the age of yofi, is age of beauty, because when we refer to beauty, we refer Rav Hirsch says to inner beauty. We refer to inner beauty, and that he talks about how the beauty of the body is a result of a beautiful soul. And how that is why a child of age seven is beautiful. He says beauty is not about makeup, and beauty is not about being attractive, but beauty is about an inner beauty that he said. Rav Hirsch writes here that as soon as a young person. Thinks that he or she is beautiful and would like to remain so, at that point their beauty has vanished, because all of a sudden they've become vain, and now that initial beauty is gone. And he writes here, and I'm quoting from this essay on page 139 of the 8th volume of the Collected Writings, he writes, "A beautiful body is the result of a beautiful soul, and he or she who would like to be beautiful, or if we want to become beautiful, all we need to do is to keep away from sin and base passion. Every beautiful thought, every fine sentiment, every lofty resolve makes one beautiful, and the most beautiful face is the one least disfigured by the pernicious colors and lines of base passion, malice, arrogance, and vanity. That is why a child is at the peak of its beauty, and our sages say that if we would still be tamim, as pure as angels at the age of 20, we would also keep the angelic beauty we possessed when we were 7. So this is innocence. Innocence is reflected by the yofi, by the beauty. When we talk about below chet, we don't refer to innocence. We refer to someone who has faced the challenges and has persevered. And that is an approach to life, and that Rav Hirsch sees in this medrash of Kibas Kuf, Kibas Chaf, and Kibas Chaf, Kibas Zayin. And this is the message that's being espoused in the breakdown of Sarah's life into three categories, and the ideals that are represented by each category. Then Rav Hirsch turns to the phrase at the end of the pasuk, where after the pasuk says, "Vayuchaye Sarah me'ah shana ve'esrim shana v'shem ashanim shenei chaye Sarah." It concludes and says, it repeats again, these were the years of the life of Sarah. And Rav Hirsch questions this repetition, but explains that the concluding pasuk is to say that first it's to say that they were chayei Sarah. All these years were the life of Sarah, in that she lived every day, and every day was meaningful. Every day had a purpose to it, and there was not one day where she would look back on it with regret. That is that every day was really lived to its fullest. But it also, Shnei Chaye Sarah, means they were years out of the life of Sarah. These 127 years were not Chaye Sarah. They're not the life of Sarah. They are Shnei Chaye Sarah, years out of the life of Sarah, referring to the fact that there are years beyond life in this world, and that this is just a portion of her existence, but the main part of life, the main part of her existence would be in the world beyond, in Olam Haba. And this is also something hinted to in this pasuk, the concept of an olam haba, a reward that awaits us beyond this world. That these are just shnei chaye Sarah, and that is how Rav Hirsch understands the ending of this pasuk. The next parakhav dalid. At the beginning of the parak, we are introduced to Avraham in his old age, as we quoted the pasuk earlier, "Va'Avraham zakim ba bayamim," and the pasuk adds, "V'Hashem beirach es Avraham bakol." Hashem blessed Avraham with everything. And Rav Hirsch here quotes a Gemara from Bava Basra, Daf Tes Zayin Amud Beis, which brings the opinions of five Amoraim and their understanding of what Bakol means. What does it mean that Hashem blessed Avraham with everything? So Rav Hirsch brings this Gemara with the opinions of five Amoraim, and he explains how this gives us into an insight into how Avraham related to the world around him. So the Gemara Bava Basra says, and we'll cite the five opinions, and then we'll go through how Rav Hirsch explains them all. So the Gemara says, Tanya, Rabbi Meir Omer. Rabbi Meir says, Bakol means Shelo Hay Salo Bas. Hashem blessed him with everything in that he did not have a daughter. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, the second opinion is Rabbi Yehuda, who says, Shehoy Salo Bas. Hashem blessed him with everything in that he not only had a son, but he also had a daughter. Exactly the opposite of the first opinion of Rabbi Meir. The third opinion is Acherim Omrim, others who say, Shehaya Bakol Shema, that he had a daughter, and not only did he have a daughter, but the daughter's name was Bakol. So Hashem blessed Avraham Bakol with a daughter whose name was Bakol. The fourth opinion is Rabbi Eliezer HaModoi, Omer, It's Tagninus Hoysalola Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu had a deep understanding of astrology, Shekol Malchei Mizrach U'Marav Mashkim in Lepischo, that all the kings of east and west would rise up early to go to his door to seek his advice. And the fifth opinion is Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai Omer, Even Tova Haisa Teluya B'Tzavaro Shel Avraham. Avraham had this precious gem that hung around his neck, V'chol Chola Shehoya Roe Osa V'Yad Nisrape. And every sick person who would look at this gem would immediately be healed. And that is V'Hashem Birachas Avraham Bakol, that Hashem blessed Avraham with everything. A full blessing that Hashem gave him unbelievable things. So Rav Hirsch quotes this Gemara and goes through each of these opinions one by one to explain what they mean. And he first addresses the opinion of Rabbi Meir, the first opinion, who says that Hashem blessed Avraham with everything in that he did not have a daughter. And Rav Hirsch says it's hard to understand this literally, to say that a person is blessed when he has no daughters. And first of all, that's a strange thing to say when we know the mitzvah of Pru Revu requires a person to have a son and a daughter. And besides, Rav Hirsch says that this is the place that makes least sense to show that having a daughter would be a bad thing, because it's sandwiched between the stories of two prominent women, two of our imahos, the story of Sarah and her death and her burial, but where we see how in the first pasuk of the parasha the Torah praises Sarah, and then this is the prelude to the story of Rivka and her gemilas chasadim, and how she comes and becomes the replacement for Sarah. And takes and becomes the second of the imahos. And so Davka here, between these two women, the Torah is going to say, Hashem birachas Avraham bakol, because you didn't have a daughter, Baruch Hashem? No, of course that can't be. That can't be what the Torah means. But rather, Rav Hirsch explains that Rabbi Meir's opinion, it means that Avraham was in a special circumstance in which it was better for him not to have a daughter. Because we see here now in this upcoming parasha that Avraham chooses a wife for Yitzchak. The wife comes to their home and she becomes a daughter-in-law of Avraham Avinu in his house. And this is especially true, obviously, in those days where the son stayed in the father's house and the new wife came to live in the home of her father-in-law. Now, if Avraham had a daughter, he would have to find someone to marry her, but then she would go off to that household. And Avraham's household was the only household that lived a life of following the word of Hashem. And so while Yitzchak could get away with marrying a woman from Haran and bringing her to his home, where he set the tone. He and Avraham, his father, set the tone. But if Avraham would have to marry off his daughter, she would be married to someone from Haran or someone from Canaan or Aram or wherever. and she would go to their home and be subject to their influence. And in the end, what would be likely to happen as one woman all alone among people who serve idols and believe in ideals antithetical to the ideals of Avraham Avinu, his daughter would likely be lost. Be lost cause. She would. This is really the question that is discussed by Chazal when it comes to Yaakov and Esav, and how Yaakov hides Dina and does not want Dina to marry Esav, and whether that's a correct decision or an incorrect decision. And this is a similar discussion. Rav Hirsch really imposes that discussion here on this concept of Avraham's daughter or lack thereof. And so he says that Rabbi Meir feels that it's a bracha for Avraham not to have a daughter, because had he had a daughter, she would have gone over to the other side. She would have been a lost cause. And better that Avraham should not have a daughter and not have to suffer to lose his daughter to the non-believers in the world around him. And that's how Rabbi Meir felt. It was a bracha of Hashem not to give him a daughter. Rabbi Huda feels exactly the other way around. Rabbi Huda says he had a daughter, and that was the biggest bracha, because he had a daughter who was married to someone from the nations around him, but succeeded in spreading the word of Hashem as her father had done to the other nations. And he was her daughter even after she got married. And she was, his messenger to the rest of the world. Avraham lives in his house and sets the tone there, but now he has a daughter who goes out among a strange people and nevertheless brings the message of Hashem to the world. And that is a big bracha. Again, we see Rabbi Huda and Rabbi Meir, and their opinion, whether it's their opinions about Avraham having a daughter or not, really run parallel to the discussion of Dina and how whether Yaakov should have given her to Esav or not. The third opinion is really builds off of Rabbi Yehuda's opinion and says that he had a daughter also, but adds the point that her name was Bakol. And the added point here is that this daughter was Bakol, and that's not just that he had a daughter, and that was a bracha, but this daughter really meant everything to Avraham, because she was able to attract more attention to Avraham and help promote his message. People came to Avraham because they heard about him through his daughter, and she established a connection between Avraham and the outside world, and this was Bakol. This was beyond everything that Avraham could have ever hoped for. Not only was he doing his own work from his own tent where he was, but he also had good PR out there through his daughter, who not only was, according to Rabbi Yehuda, he had a daughter and she remained his daughter. She remained a believer despite the fact that she was married and had to move out of his house. And according to the Achirim, she was his daughter and was also good PR and brought more business for Avraham Avinu. So it's beyond just having a daughter and her remaining one of his. The fourth opinion, Rabbi Elazar Mudai, changes the discussion from a daughter to something different and talks about Avraham's knowledge of astrology and how he held consultations for kings from the east and west. And what this means, writes of Hirsch, is that the nations of the world saw that Avraham had good fortune. They saw that he became wealthy. They saw that he was successful in all that he did. And they wanted a piece of that. They wanted to know what was his secret. They thought perhaps he had some way to read the stars to know how to find good fortune. And so they came to him seeking advice. And Avraham's response was, of course, to believe in Hashem. And that was the key to his success. So they came to him believing in some sort of astrology. So Hashem's bracha to Avraham Bakol is that Hashem gave Avraham wealth and success, and that acted as a magnet to the nations of the world, because they wanted to associate with someone who was so successful, and they wanted to find out his secret. Of course, they didn't realize what his secret was, but once they came to Avraham, he shared his secret with them and was able to talk to them about Hashem as the key to his success. And Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, the fifth opinion, talks about this precious gem that Avraham had around his neck. So Rehur says that what this means is that Avraham had this magnetic personality, It wasn't necessarily his external possessions that were his bakol, that were his gift that allowed him to, enabled him to attract other people, but it was just who he was. His very personality was attractive to people. People wanted to befriend him. People wanted to associate with him. And that was the makol that Hashem gave him he made him into a friendly person, a person who others want to be around. And that was the gem hanging around his neck, which Rav Yochai adds that all sick people who looked at it became healed, because people who were sick in terms of their neshama, in terms of their religious beliefs, they were idolaters. But when they got a good look of this personality of Avram Avinu, when they associated with him, they were healed because they absorbed his message and were able to take it to heart. So these five opinions of what Bakol means, Rav Hirsch explains them to show us how Avram related to the world around him, and how Hashem gave him the ability to interact with the world and really brought the world to Avraham's doorstep and enabled him to conduct the outreach that he very much wanted to do, and to, in a sense, be mekarev the world around him and made his job easier through the blessing of Bakol in whatever form that may have taken, depending on which opinion you want to work with. One last thought I want to share in this parsha is at the end of the story of Eliezer's journey to Haran and his discovery of Rivka, and he brings her back. And in the final pasuk of this parak, we read how Rivka meets Yitzchak, and Vayivyeha Yitzchak ha'ohel ha'sara imo, that Yitzchak brings Rivka to the tent of Sarah, his mother. Vayikach es Rivka, he took Rivka, vaytihilo li'isha, she was a wife to him, vayeha veha, and he loved her. Vayinochem Yitzchak achareimo, and Yitzchak was comforted after his mother's death, and Rivka was able to take her place. And Rav Hirsch points out here that the order of what happened is first Vatzihi lo li'isha, first she became his wife, and then Vayeha veha, and then he loved her. And here Rav Hirsch talks about that he says that the marriage of the first Jewish son, that Yitzchak, as the son of Avram Avinu, is the first Jewish marriage. This first Jewish marriage serves as a role model for all future Jewish marriages, and serves it shows us how marriages should be arranged, in a sense. That he says that we don't try to find a marriage based on passion, but we base our marriage on reason and judgment, Rav Hirsch writes. And he says that young people turn to their parents and relatives or other people who they know to help them find someone who is suited to them, and someone who will be a good life partner for them based on their characteristics. And then after they are married, love increases afterwards as they come to know each other better, Rav Hirsch writes. So and then Rav Hirsch contrasts this to the fleeting concept of love in the non-Jewish world. And Rav Hirsch writes, and I'll quote, he writes, most non-Jewish marriages are made on the basis of what they call love, but we need only glance at novelistic depictions taken from life, and we immediately see the vast gulf in the non-Jewish world between the love of the partners before marriage and what happens afterward. How dull and empty everything seems after marriage. How different from what the two partners had imagined beforehand. This sort of love is blind. Each step into the future brings new disillusionment. Not so is Jewish marriage, of which it says, Vayikach es Rivka vatihi lo isha vayeha veha. Here the wedding is not the culmination, but only the beginning of true love. And when Rav Hirsch wrote this, and it's worth noting that when Rav Hirsch writes that the wedding is not the culmination, you can fully appreciate what he's writing if you're aware of the original German. And here it's in the footnotes to the to an essay in the eighth volume of the Collected Writings. There's an essay called "A Jewish Woman," where Rav Hirsch at length goes through some prominent women in Tanakh, and then it goes through the Perek of Eshes Chayil and goes through some examples of women's role as seen through stories in the Gemara to explain the role of the woman in Jewish life. And he discusses this pasuk in the section covering Rivka. It's on pages 107 and 108 in the eighth volume. And here the editors have been so kind to put a little footnote here explaining the play on words that Rav Hirsch is employing in the German. Because in German, the word for wedding is Hochzeit, which means literally high time or climax. So Rav Hirsch is pointing out how the wedding is not the Hochzeit. It's not the highest time in the relationship of a couple. It's the beginning. The highest time comes later on. The love increases as the marriage continues. It's not that we don't look for necessarily for love first and then contract a marriage based on those feelings. But the marriage is based on other things, and then the love develops from there. And I'm going to quote from Rav Hirsch, where he writes this in the essay in Collected Writings. He writes, "Here again we see a time-honored Jewish custom with its good common sense that has proven more effective than any other approach in the promotion of personal happiness. In other societies, marriages are made by emotions as blind as their god of love. Passion acts as the matchmaker, thus excluding from the very outset the role of calm reflection in a matter where dispassionate consideration would seem to be of the essence. Partners whose emotions are blinded by passion never get to know one another before marriage. As a result, they enter marriage with notions and expectations that have no relation to reality. But very soon, reality brings disillusionment, chilling the passions, and estranging the partners from one another. Jewish marriages, on the other hand, are made on the basis of calm deliberation and careful reflection, testing whether the prospective partners are mutually compatible in their emotions, character, personality, and all the other factors that determine marital happiness. These are considerations and reflections of which neither the young man nor the young woman are capable, but which are within the capability of the parents, relatives, and friends of both parties. Only when good common sense would approve of the union are the couple's feelings toward one another taken into account. That is why statistics show a disproportionately higher percentage of happy marriages among Jews than among members of other societies." So, and feel free to see more there on page 108 in the eighth volume of Collected Writings. But this is how Rav Hirsch approaches the motivations behind a Jewish marriage and the place of love in the Jewish marriage and how love belongs after marriage and not necessarily before, or at least love increases after marriage and should not be looked at as an absolute requirement in its full bloom prior to marriage. And how Rav Hirsch talks about the benefits of what we now call the shidduch system, and how that is, and how we shouldn't be taken in by the culture around us and their views of marriage.